Let's take a journey back to 2003. Canadian teen sensation Avril Lavigne was topping the charts and turning the music industry upside down. But what if I told you that the Avril Lavigne we know and love might not be the same Avril? What? Did Avril die? Was she replaced by a doppelganger? I'm Joanne McNally, and I'm doing a deep dive into a notorious internet conspiracy. Who replaced Avril Lavigne? Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I find it kind of wild to think about all the things that are different because of O.J. Simpson. Like, I'm talking about television news, reality TV, so many adaptations of the O.J. story. O.J. Simpson died last week. Today, how covering O.J. reshaped entertainment. I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. Okay, let me take you back for a moment. It is June of 1994, okay? You, like everyone else, you're watching Larry King on CNN, waiting for some kind of update on O.J. Simpson. And at this moment, O.J. is one of the most famous men of his era, was just charged with the murder of his wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and also her friend, Ron Goldman. Larry begins the show. Larry King, your friend, begins the show with the question that everyone else is asking, which is, where is O.J. Simpson? But then, after a few minutes, everyone knows exactly where O.J. is.
Okay, I'm going to have to interrupt this call. I understand we're going to go to a live picture in Los Angeles. Is that correct? Okay. This is Interstate 5, and this is courtesy of KCALR, one of our L.A. affiliates. Police believe that that O.J. Simpson is in that car.
It is, I think, hard to remember the world before the white Ford Bronco car chase. But before the story, O.J. Simpson was one of the most compelling and beloved celebrities in America. He's a Heisman Trophy winner. He's an NFL Hall of Famer, a popular sportscaster, a somewhat successful comedic actor. O.J. Simpson died last week, and as you can imagine, his death did not bring the usual stuff, right? Did not bring the sort of loving tributes you see when iconic figures die. And that's because O.J.'s legacy today has very little to do with anything that he did on the field or on the screen. His legacy is one of the most famous murder trials of all time, a trial that pushed conversations about race, about privilege, about domestic violence into the national spotlight. And I think in many respects, the unprecedented media hysteria over his trial kind of set the table for the TMZ-driven, true crime, reality TV-obsessed world that we're in now. So that's what we're going to talk about. On today's podcast, we're going to talk about how those events 30 years ago are still sort of making their way through culture right now. Commotion regulars David Dennis Jr. and JL Richardson are here. Also, first-timer Eric Harvey. JL, David, Eric, welcome to the show. How's everybody feeling?
Doing good.
Great.
Thanks for having me.
Hey. Pleasure. JL, listen, I'm going to start with you. The death of OJ is a weird one to grapple with, you know, especially for you, since you grew up in a football household. Your dad, Chuck Ealy, all-star quarterback in the CFL in the 70s. Tell me a bit about, like, what OJ represented for you growing up and how you're processing this moment.
Yeah, I think lots of people have different feelings about football and football players. Yeah. And, you know, for me, the man I loved the most in the world, first in the world, was a football player. And I had nothing but positive things to think about, black men and football. Yeah. And I actually thought as a child that OJ looked a little bit like my dad. And there was this sort of resemblance physically to him that was like, my dad could have been a movie star in the States if they had had black quarterbacks in the NFL kind of thing. And I sort of saw him as like this life my dad might have had. Ugh.
Of course.
But I think what was interesting when the news broke, I put it right in the family chat. It felt strange. It felt weird. And one of the things that I remember is watching all the clips of OJ talking, and there's some post trial videos of him talking. And I realized how different he was from my father. You know, my father was this humble, genuine, kind man, still is. And OJ just always had this arrogance about him, always had this kind of selfishness, this kind of narcissism about him. And you saw it through the trial, after the trial. And so it was this moment where I had to put together these two faces, one of a man I love and one of a man who just was a horrible disappointment and a horrible, you know, kind of face for the world.
That is a lot to go through just looking at the news, dude. So I thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Eric, let's go back to 94. Let's go back to that moment. Take us back to that Bronco chase. What do you remember about that day?
Yeah, I remember it vividly. I was 16 years old, and at the time it was my first job. I worked at the Dollar Theater. I think most cities have the kind of second run movie theaters.
Yeah.
And we got to go into movies free as part of the job. And so me and a friend of mine were seeing this movie called Cops and Robbersons. I don't know if anybody remembers this movie. It's Chevy Chase.
You just made that movie up on the spot. I've never heard of this movie's existence in my life.
I may have just made this movie up. But me and my buddy were watching this movie for free because we're broke and we're in high school. And one of my buddies, halfway during the movie, who was working as an usher that day, comes into the back of the theater. We used to prank each other and say, "So-and-so, your mother is here," you know, if we knew they were in the theater.
Yeah.
And he said, "Eric Harvey, will you come to the usher podium, please?" And I thought he was just, you know, pranking me or something.
Yeah.
So I came out there and he said, he was older than me. He was in his 20s. And he said, "I need you to do me a favor. I need you to do it right now. I need you to go to my apartment, and there's a VHS tape on the top of the TV. It's a, you know, blank tape. We just had these at the time, right?"
Yeah.
He said, "Pop it in the VCR, turn on the TV, put on CNN, hit record. Don't ask any questions. OJ's running from the police."
Oh, right? Wow.
And I still at this time thought, what, you know, what exactly is going on here? Right. So I run back into the theater. And I tell my buddy, I whisper him just like, "Hey, long story.
But I got to go do this thing." Yeah.
Yeah. Too much to say in the middle of a movie. And so I run, you know, run to my car. You know, his apartment was like a few minutes away. And I sit there and watch the whole thing. Right. I mean, you know, this is like the next playoff game was on. The whole, you know, there was a lot going on. But yeah, I watched this entire chase and recorded it. I don't know what my buddy did, if he got out of the theater or watched the movie.
Yeah.
Or if my other friend still has that tape. But that was, you know, at that time, it was just the biggest media moment, I think, I ever experienced.
I love that story because it illustrates how important of a media moment it was, that someone would be like, no, drop what you're doing. I need you to go home and record the news so you don't miss it. Like, I think, David, I've been watching the reaction on social media this week. And what has been really interesting is like, you know, people sharing their stories of how like their teachers like wheeled a TV into the classroom so you can watch this thing. And then like you see young people are like, "You guys are making this up. That's clearly, you know, this is clearly a lie. That didn't happen." They just can't fathom how big of a deal this trial of that chase was. What are your most lasting memories from that moment, do you think?
Yeah, I saw the people in disbelief at the wheel TVs coming out. I remember there were three moments in my like K-12 life. I was like 8 or 9 during the whole OJ situation. There are three moments in my K-12 life when they wheeled this out for the news. 9/11, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the OJ Simpson trial. Like, these were the three things that I remember. And for the OJ trial, they wheeled that bad boy into the lunchroom. Like, it was in the lunchroom in the cafeteria during lunch. Like, that's how big this was. Everybody who passed through lunch saw this OJ thing happening. And I also distinctly remember when I was in fourth grade, my third grade teacher came and sat by us at the lunch table and debated me about if OJ was guilty or not. And I'm like, "You are," and like at the time I was like, "I don't know, like people are saying not and he's probably not, I don't know, I'm 8, lady, like why are we debating?" And she was like, had an opinion that she was sharing with children, like, this is how big of a deal this thing was.
It's so funny because I feel like it was the beginning of memes in my mind. I was 14, so maybe it was just the beginning for me, but like, I remember the Ford Bronco t-shirts that would be for sale all the time. The juice is loose. There were all these like slogans that were going around at the time. Yeah. And when I was in high school, I was in grade 9 or 10. And I remember when the trial was gone, I wore my hair down intentionally and slid like headphones up my shirt and under my hair so that I could listen. I don't know, on a Walkman. I don't even know what I was listening to.
Incredible.
But my teacher wouldn't wheel the TV in. And so I had to like come up with my own plan for watching and listening and hearing it live. Cause I knew my dad would be watching it. And I was like, I need to know what's happening when it happens.
Can I just, before I move on here, can I just get you, JL, to tell me where you were when the verdict dropped?
That's where I was when The Verdict dropped. That was the, like, I was sitting in my classroom, my grade 10 English class, headphones under my hair, like totally absorbed.
Like
in
the
case.
Teacher going on about Shakespeare and you're like, sorry.
The rest of the class is doing a writing exercise. Yeah. I became an author, ironically, but the class is doing a writing
exercise.
And I'm just like, what is happening to OJ? And it was just, it was a wild time. It was a really wild time.
So Eric, when you, so you put out a book in 2021, it's called Who Got the Camera, which looks at this rise of the reality-based entertainment through the lens of gangster rap, but also TV shows like Cops, which is a TV show that I've tried as hard as possible to forget existed, even though it ran for a wildly long time and was so popular. But also major news events like the LA riots, also the OJ trial. Can you talk a little bit about like the factors that made this OJ trial such a giant pop culture sort of powder keg moment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, after OJ's death, you know, you saw a lot of people saying, you know, OJ invented like a particular moment. The OJ trial invented this sort of new tabloid media, cable news, 24/7. And it didn't. That was about 10 years earlier when this whole thing started. But OJ, the OJ trial was this big kind of acme of this moment. So we look back to the mid to late 80s, the Reagan era. And what's called culture starting to evolve, right? So starting in the late 80s, you have daytime talk shows, Oprah, Geraldo, Donahue. They were kind of dominating the daytime media landscape.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they did was they were sort of relitigating civil rights using this transformed media landscape as the backdrop, right? So, you know, walking up and down the aisles with all these average people kind of talking about, you know, their hot takes on what's going on. You know, and you had Oprah goes to Forsyth County, Georgia, where no black person lived for 75 years, did a whole show from there. Donahue had David Duke on his show, platforming David Duke, right?
Yeah.
And Geraldo Rivera, of course, had, you know, sat a white supremacist next to a civil rights activist. And then everything turned into like a big wrestling match. And this was all in 86, 87, 88.
Yeah.
As we know.
And they say media's wild now. I'm like, were you around the 80s?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this was the exact same time when Public Enemy and NWA were coming out of Compton and Long Island and waging war against the same kind of institutionalized racism in an outlandish and combative way, mixing entertainment and claims to reporting, street reporting. And so at the same time, you know, this is kind of the tail end of the Reagan era law and order culture that permeated popular media. So you got the true crime genre sort of exploding again. You know, true crime dates back to Joseph Pulitzer. I mean, it goes back, you know, 100 years. But this is Cops, America's Most Wanted, A Current Affair, Dateline. You
know, this
is everything. Everything on TV feels like. It feels like some kind of verdict or feels like some kind of, you know, a moment to decide about how you feel. Like everything is like a lens into how you view sort of larger social issues.
And where you're going to get multiple stories and then you're going to have to decide who you think is guilty, right? Okay. Like there's this sense
Indeed.
Of like
yes.
But so it's against that backdrop, though, David, that like, you know, like I think like now if a celebrity was charged with murdering their wife, you know, if their history, you know, was their history of abuse was made public, there would be instantly disowned. Immediately, like, people would be like, no, I'm not on board with this person. But, like, it's kind of wild to look back at the fact that OJ himself became a site for controversy. He became something of a folk hero to some people. Because like, I think if you watch the footage of the white Bronco chase, you see some people on the overpasses cheering him on. How do you explain that to someone in 2024 and go like, yeah, this guy was just charged with a double murder and people on the overpasses being like, go OJ?
Yeah, I mean, this is you have to rethink about what they were actually doing. It's almost like, you know, we don't root, you know, for the Yankees are in the World Series, the Celtics are in the finals. People don't root, you know, for the team they're going against. We're rooting against the Yankees and the Celtics, right?
Right.
And in this instance, the Yankees and the Celtics are like white supremacists. You know, racism, culture,
Mark
that
Furman.
Culture, like the criminal justice system that gave us, know. That gave us, you know, the Rodney King verdict, that gave us all this stuff. And so people were not really cheering for OJ because, like, everybody knew OJ knows OJ don't rock with black people like that. So it was not like, this is not like Nelson Mandela, like, riding down the street, right? This is an idea about, like, who we dislike. And as much as we did not really rock with OJ, knew he didn't rock with us. We really, really, really are rooting against the same system in LA that was doing a lot of, you know, unspeakable and still is doing a lot of unspeakable crimes against black folks. So that's really what the cheering was about.
I saw a headline that said black people didn't love OJ Simpson. They hated the LAPD. I think that sort of sums up the sentiment that you're describing there. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Okay, we are back. My name is Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. And I'm here with Jael Richardson, David Dennis Jr., and Eric Harvey. And we're talking about O.J. Simpson, how that whole saga sort of resonates today in entertainment and pop culture. So I want to switch gears a bit. It's interesting that, you know, to me, on the day that we found out that O.J. had died, one of the top trending topics on Twitter was the late Canadian comedian Norm Macdonald, who spent most of 1995 telling jokes like this one.
This week at the O.J. Simpson trial, the infamous bloody glove was finally introduced into evidence, and O.J. didn't help his case any by blurting out, "There it is, I've been looking all over for that thing."
There's a lot more where that came from. That was just one example of the kinds of jokes that Norm told. Jael, what did you make of the way that the trial was kind of used for laughs on basically every comedy show at the time?
Yeah, it was a weird time for me. I grew up... just as a background, like in a quite privileged home. I grew up around a lot of white people and not a lot of black people at times, both in my friendship circle and like my family circle. And I remember at that time, the difference between talking about OJ in the house when we were watching the trial and hearing about it on TV from people like Norm Macdonald, hearing neighbors and other people talk about it. And it's the first time I remember this discomfort with what was happening and something I couldn't quite define. I couldn't quite explain.
Yeah.
I knew there was this racial element to it. And this discussion that had to do with how black people were responding, some, and how some white people were responding. But I also, like, I didn't find the jokes funny in the same way that my white friends found them funny. Sure. And I didn't quite know how to talk about it. And for me now, looking at things that unveiled now in 2020 and looking back, I can see what was happening. There was a sort of understanding. But OJ was a really hard character to have those conversations about because he was terrible, you know? And so you're having these thoughts about, and I really like what the statement about we're really against the LAPD, because I remember my dad just being like, I don't know, but those cops screwed up. Those cops are, you know, and I remember him talking about it. Yeah. And it was the first time I remember questioning police and questioning the justice system and doing it in that way. And I think OJ just made it really complicated.
David, what Jael's saying there is that white people and black people might have not been laughing at the same things in these moments, might have not been sort of laughing at the same jokes. How do you remember the way that humor sort of processed this moment back in the 90s?
Well, what was interesting to me is I watched a lot of the Norm Macdonald stuff after the fact. Like I would watch the reruns on Comedy Central when they would play SNL. And it was actually informative to me because I learned the ins and outs of the trial from Norm Macdonald. Like he was the Larry King. Like I knew people, you know, at eight, I know the you know, broad strokes. Cato Kaelin, glove don't fit, must quit. But when Norm Macdonald every week was giving you this information about what was going on, it was informative to me. I learned a lot about it. Now, what the problem is with these things is that we end up normalizing something like this, right? And I'm sure that the family of the victims were not laughing at these jokes. Like there's, you know, their comedy can be something that can illuminate, but it also toes a fine line about normalizing what, like, incredible violence and the terrible thing that happened. And so, you know, I think some people towed that line, but I think that we also got into a place where OJ became a punchline not until the movie and the documentary really contextualized really what happened back then.
You said the name Cato Kaelin, and I want to explain to people who that is, but I'm going to do that in just a moment, actually, because this will be useful context. So the OJ trial made overnight celebrities. It was a weird moment. It made overnight celebrities out of a lot of people just associated with that trial. Have a listen to this. So I got to explain to people what you just heard. What you just heard there is this recurring bit on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. It's called The Dancing Itos. It's a troupe of Asian men dressed like the OJ trial judge, Lance Ito, who were sort of brought out to dance. Sometimes it would strip for the audience. And then there was also Cato Kaelin, who we just mentioned. He was parodied on SNL skits. He was one of the witnesses in the trial. And then he went on to star in a bunch of reality shows. He has his own clothing line, which is a sentence I can't believe I'm saying out loud. Eric, all of this seems ridiculous, I think, in retrospect. But if this trial was happening now, do you think the media frenzy would be around it any differently at all?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely certain things that are going to be different. You know, there's not, you know, even at the time, so back in the 90s, as we all probably remember, it felt like, holy cow, there are so many different media options right now. I don't even know where to go. And then you compare that to today, and it's you know, just increasingly more atomized and more fragmented. And there are these occasional things that sort of bring discourse together, and it congeals around a certain topic for a certain time. But when you think about like pre-internet analogs for Twitter, social media, I mean, this sort of democratized public sphere that kind of any average person can stake their claim to, can participate in. This is daytime talk shows, right? This is what Phil Donahue kind of invented in the 70s, that Oprah kind of perfected in the 80s, and Geraldo turned into kind of a proto Fox News in the late 80s, early 90s. You know, because, you know, we always say, oh, if Twitter was around back in the you know, in this era, oh my goodness, what would, and it's just like, no, Twitter kind of was around, right? You had to get tickets to go to Harpo Studios, or you had to get tickets to go, you know, somewhere. But I mean, this was a space where average people could participate in mass media discourse and kind of have their moment of quote unquote viral fame. So there is a lot. I mean, there's a ton of differences, but there are a lot of, and we have to remember also that, you know, once daytime talk shows kind of took hold, I mean, this was a space for marginalized voices to, you know, from around the world to kind of have their say in ways that kind of mainstream news would always sort of block out.
Yeah. I heard in there somewhere a defense of Jerry Springer. I'm going to want to come back to that at some point in my life, but not right now.
No way.
David, what aspects of the OJ saga sort of resonate with you the most in 2024, do you think?
Yeah, right now what resonates to me the most is just the reminder of what this criminal justice system does, and like what racism, white supremacy does. Like nobody is, you know, free from it. Like everybody becomes a victim of this. Like we look at something like Rodney King, and you think that this only impacts Black people and all that stuff, but all oppressions will eventually get to everybody, right? And what we have here is a system that was built for people like OJ to never, you know, to go to jail, right? For people like OJ to never make it in life, even when he's, you know, a teenager, right? But that system, when it works in a different way, ends up where two people are killed and there's no justice for it, right? And these are white folks, right? And so this is unthinkable that we could have something where a Black man kills two, you know, allegedly kills two white people, and there's all this evidence and he walks away. And that is what happens in these oppressive systems, that they're like, anything, transphobia, homophobia, racism, all that stuff. You think you are safe because you're not in that group, and you are not. And it will come for all of us eventually. And I think that is the lasting legacy of the O.J. Simpson trial.
I wish we had time to talk about the American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson, because there's so much to talk about there. But we can't at the moment. But Jael, maybe let me just ask you this general question. How do you think the O.J. trial impacted the way we consume news and entertainment?
I mean, I think it just fed into it in a way that it continues to feed us now. It was funny. Yesterday, I was watching Donald Trump was going to New York for his trial, and they were following his car along the highway to his trial in New York.
And you're like, where have I seen this before?
This feels familiar. And it's this sense, especially when celebrities are involved, this combination of real life entertainment from, in this case with OJ, the true trauma of families, and the focus isn't on the trauma. It's not on the care of those families. It's not on justice. It's on the fact that he was an entertainer and a celebrity, and he continued to be an entertainer and a celebrity through a gruesome trial and post-trial. You know, I posted on Twitter and I reposted it this morning, this conversation, this interview he has in which he speaks in the hypothetical about this trial and about what happened, and drops into the first person present tense multiple times and has to step back and be like, but this is hypothetical, right? And literally walks through what happened on that day. It's bonkers. And we consume it, we watch it, and he died and there was no justice.
I often forget, actively try to act, often forget, Eric, that OJ wrote a book called If I Did It. This was a book that came out in 2006. I mean, like, he's someone who was not above using the fame of the trial to just sort of advance the OJ name. Maybe you got 30 seconds left. How are you thinking about the way that OJ shaped news and entertainment?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people were, you know, have said over the past few days, you know, OJ paved the way for Trump. You know, I don't necessarily think that's a one-to-one correlation, but I do think that OJ was sort of proof of concept of this media environment, that you can be a charismatic in your own way anti-hero of sorts, and you can also be sort of a part-time con man, you know, selling stuff on the side, you know, sort of ripping people off, you know, with you know, books capitalizing on your fame, etc. And that you can stay in the media, and that the quote-unquote mainstream media won't at a certain point act as something of a bulwark against you. They will almost embrace you because you give them ratings. And so
that's,
you know, OJ really proved that sort of chasing that infamy and chasing that that kind of anti-hero status is a good way to do news.
That idea of him being a prototype is really going to stick with me. I really appreciate it. Eric, Jael, and David, I really appreciate you guys being here. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Eric Harvey is a professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan and the author of Who Got the Camera? A History of Rap and Reality. Jael Richardson is the author of Because You Are and Gutter Child. David Dennis Jr. is a sports and culture journalist in Atlanta. That is it for the show. My name is Al-Amin Abdul Mahmoud. Hey, I'm going to be back tomorrow. And you know what? I will see you then. Thank you.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.